We're in 1 Kings chapter 14, and we want to read verses 14 through 20 as we begin this morning. 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 14 through 20. Betray, you got that for us?
Moreover, the Lord shall raise him up a king over Israel, who shall put up the house of Jeroboam and pray. The Lord shall smite Israel as a reed shaken in the Lord, and he shall root up Israel out of his good land, which he gave to their fathers, and shall scatter them beyond the river, because they have made their groves, their own Lord's anger. And he shall give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, who did sin and made Israel to sin. And Jeroboam's wife arose and departed and came to Tirzah. And when she came to the threshold of the door, the child died. And they buried him, and all of Israel mourned for him, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by the hand of his servant Ahijah the prophet. And the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he warred and how he reigned, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel. In the days of Jeroboam remained 2 and 20 years, and he slept with his fathers, and Nadab his son came in his stead.
Okay, so that brings the end of Jeroboam's reign to an end, as it's recorded there. And of course, we'll see some other pieces of information about his reign and some of the things that happened as it pertained to the direct interactions with the kings of Judah, especially in 2 Chronicles. But the primary focus on what we read about in Jeroboam's reign is what he did from the start as after he became king of the 10 tribes that were north of Judah and Benjamin. All those tribes of Israel, Judah and Benjamin, were the southernmost, but everything north of that, Jeroboam reigned over, as God had had prophesied to the same prophet Ahijah back in chapter 11. And so God had made Jeroboam king over those tribes, and then he, the end of chapter 11 summarizes all those, or chapter 12 rather, lists all those sins that Jeroboam committed and established in Israel, where he set up 2 golden calves, and he put 1 in Dan and 1 in Bethel at either end of his territory. And said that those were their gods that had brought them out of Egypt, and they were to worship those golden calves in those locations and not go down to Jerusalem anymore, which was in the territory of Judah, which was under the reign of Rehoboam, Solomon's son. And he didn't want his subjects going into the territory of the rival king that he had taken over from as far as those other tribes. So he makes these golden calves, these graven images that, of course, God had. The second commandment of the 10 commandments was to not do that. The first one was not to have any other gods before them. These be your gods, O Israel, he said. So he broke the first 2 of the 10 commandments and established that as a law in his kingdom. So it wasn't just that he violated it. This was what he was leading his kingdom to do. Made up his own priests that were not Levites, of the descendants of Aaron. So he did something that God had not authorized there. Made up his own feast days that God had not authorized. Altar and everything. So he established a new religion for his kingdom so they would not have anything to do with his people, with Judah or anyone there. And he thought that would keep his kingdom safe in himself. Obviously, it worked the other way because God was against him for committing those sins and for leading his people into sin, because his subjects were required by his laws to follow these sins. And so then God sent a prophet to him in chapter 13 to rebuke him for all of that, and to prophesy against that altar that he'd made. And a miracle was done before his eyes with the altar renting in 2 and the ashes pouring out. And also when Jeroboam grabbed the prophet, his hand withered And then it was restored back at the prayer of that prophet. So he had a demonstration that this man that came to him in chapter 13 from God was a prophet of the Lord. But he didn't listen, and he did more of those sins, it tells us, at the very end of chapter 13. And then we come to chapter 14, where his son, who was young, was sick and was deathly ill. And he sent his wife in disguise to Ahijah, that first prophet that appeared to him in chapter 11 with the original prophecy that Jeroboam would become king of Israel. And he sent his wife to him to find out what was going to happen to their child. But when she came in disguise, of course, the Lord told his prophet who she was. And then prophesied not just about that child, but also about what was going to happen to Jeroboam's family. That was the first thing he said, that Jeroboam's family was going to be destroyed because of those sins. Except for this child who was ill. And God, through Ahijah, pronounced that child was going to die. But it was not because of punishment of the child. But in this case, God was showing favor to that child because he said there was good in that child's heart towards the Lord. And so God was going to spare that child from all of those punishments that were going to come upon the rest of the family. And they were going to be killed and not even be given a burial, as the prophecy was that the members of Jeroboam's household, the ones that died in the city, would be eaten of dogs. The ones that died in the field would be eaten of birds. This child was going to be mourned, was going to be buried, and spared all of those things. And so God, the Lord said that child would die. And of course, we just read in those verses that that came to pass. The child did die. And he was mourned by Israel. So this happened, as it says in verse 18, according to the word of the Lord. So the prophecy of Ahijah was fulfilled. So there's another demonstration for Jeroboam and for all Israel that this was a prophet of the Lord. And these were God's words. So abundant evidence is there for Jeroboam and for all the nation to know that the pathway that they were on was wicked and God was against them for it. So there's the prophecy against Jeroboam and his family. There was a prophecy really in favor of Jeroboam, that one righteous member of his family, even though what was in favor of him was that he was going to die, but it was going to be better than what was going to happen to the rest of them. But then we come to the last of the prophecies that the Lord makes to Ahijah, to Jeroboam's wife there. And it wasn't just going to be destruction for Jeroboam and his family. It wasn't just going to be that their son was going to die. But the prophecy is then extended to really pronouncing woe, destruction, ultimately upon whom? Eventually. Israel. That whole kingdom. So he did say that God was going to raise up a king in verse 14 over Israel who would cut off the house of Jeroboam that day, but what even now, he said. So that was on the verge of happening. That was going to happen very, very soon. So when we get to the next chapter, we're going to see that fulfilled. Who was the king that God was going to raise up to do that? Well, after Jeroboam dies, his son Nadab becomes king over Israel. But shortly after he becomes king, then there was a man named Baasha that we read about in 1 Kings 15 that killed Jeroboam's son Nadab, who had just become king, and then wiped out the rest of the family. Because the thinking was, since he usurped the throne, that's what we call a coup, right? So since he usurped the throne and killed the king, when that happens, and it's not just in places where the leader is called the king, but whatever the title a ruler has, if they're overthrown and killed and somebody takes over from them, what do they do with that person's family? And why? I mean, they'll kill all their family because they don't want anyone from that family to try to retake power. Awful things that people do for that, but that's been around for a long time. That's exactly what Baasha does, and that's his reason for destroying, killing everybody in Jeroboam's family. But of course, what do we know? This was God's work. He said he was going to make someone king over Israel who would do that. Baasha was a wicked man, so it wasn't like God took a righteous man and made him do something evil. That God doesn't do that. He took this wicked man, raised him up, and used him to fulfill his prophecies against Jeroboam. So there was going to be that immediate consequence that would come upon Jeroboam and his family that comes to pass in chapter 15, fulfilling that prophecy. But what about the rest of it? What about the prophecy against the nation of Israel and why? What does he say about Israel there? Verse 15, the Lord will smite Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. And he'll root up Israel out of this good land which he gave to their fathers and scatter them beyond the river because they have made their groves, provoking the Lord to anger. And he will give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam who did sin and who made Israel to sin. So he mentions Jeroboam there, the instigator of all of this, the chief stumbling block. But was he going to punish all the nations for the sins of one man? Who was he going to punish for Jeroboam's sins? Jeroboam. So then why is this a case where Israel could say, well, Jeroboam's the one that ate the sour grapes, why are our teeth set on edge? That was the proverb that the people of Judah spoke in Ezekiel 18, after they were in captivity in Babylon, and said, our fathers have eaten sour grapes, but it's the children's teeth, us, whose teeth are set on edge. In other words, it was our fathers that did all the evil, we didn't, and now you're punishing us for what somebody else did. And God was very displeased with that, because that's accusing God of unrighteous judgment. And he was very clear to them that it was not God's ways who were unequal, unfair. It was theirs. They were being punished for their own sins. He mentions Jeroboam here because Jeroboam was the one that started all this. But when there's somebody else that starts something that's evil and entices you to get involved in it, does that mean if you follow somebody else in evil, that they're guilty but you're innocent? Not at all. And I know we have several young people in here. This applies to all of us, whatever age we are, whatever situation we're in. But this kind of thing starts early. It often starts in the home when you got siblings, and someone of them's up to something no good, and they'll get the others involved. And I know we can all reflect, for some of us, it was a lot longer ago than others, but we can all remember when we did things that we didn't, and did we ever say, well, they started it. I mean, we know we've all said that and tried to point the finger at somebody else that they're the ones that started. It was their fault because I just went along with that. And of course, we mentioned last week at the very end, the first person in the Bible that ever did that, that ever said, hey, it wasn't me, it's their fault, was whom? Adam. So the very first sin that was ever committed, that happened, where you had somebody trying to blame somebody else for what they had done. So that happened in the very first instance of sin that ever occurred. And probably the vast majority of sins that have ever occurred since then, somewhere in that, there's been something similar going on where people try to blame others for what they've done and try to shift the responsibility. Well, since they were leading it, then it's really not me. It's not my fault. It's theirs. But what was the situation? Adam said, the woman that you gave me, and in that sense, he was actually even shifting some of the blame on God. You gave me this woman. She's the one that made me do it. But so he's blaming, in a sense, God and Eve, his wife, for what he had done. But who had eaten the fruit? Well, Eve ate first. She was deceived and took the first bite. But she gave to her husband with her, and he did eat. It tells us there in Genesis 3 and verse 6, so, or 7. Who ate the fruit? Well, Adam ate it. God told him not to. So who was responsible for that? Adam was. He wasn't innocent. So even though he had somebody that did it first and enticed him to do it, the fact is he did it. And he was responsible for his own actions. He broke God's law. So even though Eve gave him the fruit to eat, he broke God's law. He decided to do that. And when he broke God's law, that decision was not Eve's fault. And it certainly wasn't God's. That was Adam's fault. He was responsible for that choice, that action. Well, what about Israel under Jeroboam? When Jeroboam says, "These be your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of Egypt," and commands them to worship those golden calves that were not God, to worship them as God, to do these sacrifices with these priests that God had not authorized, on these days that God had not ordained, on an altar that was not of him, in service to these graven images who were not God, calling them God, and not obeying the commandments he did give them to go to the temple when they were supposed to and do the things that they were supposed to and commanded to do by God in the way and the time that God told them. So they weren't doing what God said and doing all these other things that he was against. Well, Jeroboam started that, and he was going to bear chief responsibility for that, for being the cause of it, for doing it and not repenting of it and leading all these others into sin. He was going to have a lot to answer for, as God made clear. But what about Israel? When Jeroboam said, "Worship these golden calves and call them your gods and do all these other things and don't do what God said to do," when they say, "Okay," are they innocent for that? No, whoever worshiped one of those golden calves, was that a sin or not? Now it says Jeroboam made Israel to sin. He was the one that caused it. But could Israel say, "Well, we didn't really do these sins, he did it"? No. If he tells them to do it and then they follow, if they follow someone in doing evil, are they responsible for that? Let's turn to Exodus chapter 21 and read verse 2. Chapter 20 is when God gave the Ten Commandments. And here's how it begins, the very next chapter after doing that. We should be able to understand the connection. So here God gives his commandments. Does he anticipate that there are going to be those who violate or break those commandments, those very ones he just gave? In fact, that's exactly what Jeroboam did. Here, right after giving the Ten Commandments, here's what the Lord says in Exodus 21, verse 2. Brother Peter, can you read that?
"If thou buy a Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing."
Well, I am sorry, I'm in the wrong place there. Is it 23:2? I'm sorry.
"Thou shalt not follow multitudes that do evil, neither shalt thou speak that cause to decline after many to rest judgment."
All right. Thou shalt not what? Follow a multitude to do evil. Don't follow the crowd. That's what he told his people. So, and they said, "Well, everybody else was doing." Did we ever use that one too? Well, everybody's doing that. All those excuses, they're we haven't come up with anything new. There's nothing new under the sun, as Solomon said in Ecclesiastes. There's not. And any excuse that we can come up with, no matter how clever we think we are, it's not new. It's been around for a long time. Blaming somebody else? No, Adams once started that. Saying, "Well, everybody else is doing it." I mean, that's been around for a very long time. God said, don't follow a multitude to do evil. So even if it's everybody, and we've said that plenty of times, "Well, everybody did that." No, not everybody, maybe a lot of people, maybe a multitude, but that does not excuse us to follow what is evil. We cannot do evil and use that as a legitimate explanation or excuse to try to exonerate or justify ourselves. If a multitude is doing evil and we join the multitude, then guess who's going to answer to God for doing that evil? Well, the multitude, but that multitude now includes us. We'll answer for our part in it. Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1, so right as he's giving this teaching to start the book, even before he gets to the actual Proverbs, gives us some very good instruction that includes this same principle here. Let's start reading here from Proverbs chapter 1 in verse 7 and down through verse 16. 7 through 16, Brother Stephen.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. My son, hear the instruction of my father and forsake not the law of my mother, for they shall be an ornament of grace to thy head and chains about my neck. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. If they say, come with us, let us lay wait for blood, let us lurk privily for the innocent without cause. Let us fall in love alive at the grave and whole at those that go down to the pit. We shall find all precious substance. We shall fill our house with spoil. Cast it into thy lot among us. Let us all have one purse. My son, walk not thou in the way with them. Refrain thy feet from their path, for their feet run to evil and make haste to their blood.
All right, so he starts there with verse 7. What do we need as our foundation? The fear of the Lord. What is that? We're taught what the fear of the Lord is. Psalm 34, verse 11. Come, children, hearken to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is he that desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep thy tongue from evil, thy lips from speaking guile. And what does he say to do with evil? Depart from evil, and we need to do what is good. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 13 says, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. So having a hatred of what is evil and a love for what is good, that we will turn away from all evil to do the good that God commands us to do. That's the foundation there. That's the fear of the Lord. That's the beginning of knowledge. If we hate evil and love righteousness and somebody comes along, even if it's the king and says, here, you're going to do this evil over here. If you had the fear of the Lord, what's the response to that? I can't go that way. Now, Jeroboam was the king. How many kings that have been around had as much power and ruled over a dominion to match Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon? He's one of the all-timers as far as a mighty kingdom. One of the most powerful kings that have ever lived on the earth. He ruled over a vast empire. And a great image was made of him. Now Jeroboam made two golden calves. For Nebuchadnezzar, it was one of himself. He was... certainly at that time he was not a humble man. God humbled him. There's much more to... There's a lot to Nebuchadnezzar's story, mostly in the book of Daniel. But we read about in Daniel chapter 3, which we're not going to read all that right now, but I think we're all familiar with the account there. Make a reference to that. Go read that this afternoon or whatever. But in Daniel chapter 3, that image was made of Nebuchadnezzar, and the commandment was that when the music played, everybody had to stop, fall down, and worship that image. So here was a commandment from Nebuchadnezzar, one of the most powerful rulers this earth has ever seen, that gave that commandment. I mean, how different in substance was that to what Jeroboam was telling Israel to do? And the point, but there was also with that in Daniel 3, if you don't bow down and worship that image when the music plays, you get thrown into a furnace of fire. Immediate and permanent terminal consequences if you don't do it right then. Well, what did everybody do when the music played? Down they went and they worshiped that image. Except we read about three men in Daniel chapter 3 that said they had to fear the Lord, didn't they? They hated evil, they loved righteousness, and what was it to fall down and worship the image of a man? Even if he was the most powerful man in the earth at that time. You can't worship the image of a man. You can't worship a man. You can't worship an image. Only worship God. They, being servants of God, having the fear of the Lord, could not, would not do that. And so they were brought in before him. And when they were brought in before the king with what was coming, they told him plainly what they would not do and the reason they wouldn't do it. And it made him so mad, he told them to make the furnace seven times hotter. And it even caused the death of several of the soldiers because it was overheated. And they perished from that heat. But they were thrown in then. Of course, God saved them. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. God saved them in that fiery furnace from that, where they didn't even have smoke, the smell of smoke on them. Not a hair was singed. And that was the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar learning lessons about who God was. But the fact is, here were three men with that. Did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego know that God was going to save them out of that furnace at the moment when they wouldn't worship and then brought before the king himself to explain themselves? And there's no record that God has said, hey, don't worry, you're going to be spared from any consequences. They did what was right because they had the fear of the Lord. They were serving God. So even though they were in jeopardy of being killed in a horrible way for not following that wickedness, that evil, that the multitude, all but just the three of them were doing. They wouldn't do it. So the Lord tells us that. We have to have that fear of the Lord. And he said not to, as we read in Exodus 23:2, don't follow a multitude to do evil. But he says for us to hear his instruction, to wear that instruction around us. And if sinners entice us, he said, consent thou not. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. He gives an example there that we read in Proverbs 1 of a scenario, but whatever the scenario is, what about Jeroboam's? Is the application any different? Here are your gods, these golden calves. Fall down, worship them. My son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. Follow not a multitude to do evil. But how many in the kingdom of Israel followed, went with the multitude, became the multitude, and did the evil, and when they were enticed and commanded by their king to do the evil, consented and did it? Well, the vast majority of them did it. Were they innocent for doing so? No, that's what God was in that prophecy there was against them for, and said he was going to give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam, who did sin and who made Israel to sin. He was going to do that to the whole nation because of that. Now, was that going to happen? He doesn't. With that one, he doesn't say. And when, even now. That was going to come down a bit down the road. King Solomon died about 930 B.C. So that's when Jeroboam became king of Israel. Of course, we also know that Rehoboam, Solomon's son, became king of Judah at that same time. We read that Jeroboam reigned for 22 years. But after him, after Jeroboam, there were 18 more kings. The last one was a man named Hoshea. And Hoshea's reign came to an end in 722 B.C. So that means we're looking at a period of time now of 208 years. So for this prophecy late in the reign of Jeroboam, I mean, we would be looking here at just a little, approximately 200 years, a little bit less at this point, but close to 200 years after what God said through Ahijah the prophet there about what he was going to do to the kingdom of Israel for following Jeroboam's sins. It would take all the way till Hosea, 200 years later, basically, before that was going to be fulfilled. In between there, the 17 kings between Jeroboam and Hosea, it tells us how they followed the sins of Jeroboam who made Israel to sin. So those same kings, all the successors there, without an exception, they followed those same sins. That was never changed. None of them said, okay, this was wrong. No more these golden calves, no more worshiping and calling them gods, no more making these priests that weren't descendants of Aaron to be priests, no more with these altars and these feast days that God had not authorized, no more with any of that. We're going to go back to it. We're going to go, God said, go to the temple and Jerusalem, and on these particular times, here's what we're going to do, here are the kind of sacrifices to make, here's who the priests are, and we're only going to worship and serve God and keep his commandments. None of them said that. None of them did that. None of them repented. The people didn't. They followed this wicked way of Jeroboam all the way to the end. Brother Jan?
I'm just going to comment. I mean, there's so many parallels here to what we have today where there's so many things that are accepted by everybody in the world today that's what the multitude is doing, but yet we've got to recognize and distinguish when there's something that the Lord says we're to stay away from. We've got to be able to distinguish that and say, well, this might be normal for what the world is doing, but we've got to be different from the world.
Absolutely. And he just summarized why we're spending the time on this. This is why God has given us these words, these examples, these instructions, all of this. We have to make that application. We have a multitude of world around us, and there will be people very close to us caught up in those things that will try to influence us to think that way, follow that way of the world. It's not God's way. And more and more, there will be consequences. There will be a price to pay in this world, in this life, for being like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and saying, no, we can't do that. We won't do that because we have the fear of the Lord. We serve God. And so we're not going to go the way of everybody else. I mean, today, even in the United States of America, 2018, can you face ostracization? Can you be ridiculed? Can you be tormented, persecuted, lose your job, lose whatever, if you stand up for what is taught in God's Word, which means against the things that God says are sinful and wicked? We'll be called all kinds of names. There are plenty of... there are all kinds of consequences that are out there that are coming more and more, putting more and more pressure on us to conform to this world and not follow God. But that's why we have to learn these lessons and teach our children these lessons, because we can't follow the multitude, even if it's our whole nation. That's what happened in Jeroboam's time. It was their nation, their entire kingdom. They were under that pressure. But they were not excused, and we see that God didn't justify them for going along with the evil, even though everybody else was doing it. You can't follow a multitude to do evil. All these others did, the nation, the whole crowd, and just persisted in that for 200 years. We get to 2 Kings 17, if we can turn over there briefly, where finally this is brought to pass what God prophesied through Ahijah. We won't take the time, but if you go back actually much further or earlier than that to Deuteronomy 28, when he pronounced curses on Israel if they departed from him and kept not his commandments, and gave many specific things that he was going to do to them if they left him, like they did under Jeroboam, and those very specific things that are in Deuteronomy 28 that God said would happens as a result. So they had already been warned about this, but now God, through Ahijah, is being very specific in his pronouncement against the nation of Israel for following those sins of Jeroboam. So in 2 Kings chapter 17 is when it comes to pass. That's when Hoshea becomes king of Israel, and when their kingdom falls. So let's read verses 1 through 6 here in 2 Kings 17, Brother Dave.
In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, began Hoshea, the son of Eli, to reign in Samaria over Israel 9 years. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel that were before him. Against him came up Shamazer, king of Assyria, and Hoshea became his servant and gave him presents. And the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to so the king of Egypt and brought no present to the king of Assyria, as he had done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala in harbor by the river of Gozan and in the cities of Medes.
All right, that's it. And so God had pronounced to Ahijah they were going to be carried away beyond the river. What river? It's pretty obvious he's referring to the Euphrates River, which was the border, the extent of their territory in the northeast. So beyond that, here Assyria is where they actually were taken, and in those lands that the Assyrians had conquered. But this was under Hoshea in his 9th year. This was 722 BC is when Samaria fell, and that's the end of the northern kingdom of Israel. So it starts with Jeroboam and it ends there, and they're carried away to Assyria and they're never brought back. Those 10 tribes of the north, and they became known to history as the lost tribes of Israel because they don't come back again. There's no record of them. They were, as far as their morals and their religion, those were people of the world, and they just were assimilated into those places where they were carried off. So they had lost their spiritual distinctiveness long before, and they lost their physical distinctiveness at that time too. So they were gone. That's the end of them. Of course, many, many of them perished. But Hoshea, that last king, is interesting, but the 19th king of that northern kingdom of Israel, those 10 tribes, was their best one, at least as far as the description is concerned. What is the best thing you can say about the best king that they had in the north? That he wasn't as bad as the other ones. That's what it said there in verse 2. He didn't do evil like the kings of Israel that were before him. But what's the first thing it says about Hoshea in verse 2? He did that which was evil. So the best one was just the least evil. So was he good? No, he was evil. He just wasn't as evil as the others, but he was still evil. None of them repented. That's the best one and the last one. And there they go, beyond the river, just like God said by Ahijah. All right, let's read verses 20 through 23 here, and he's going to tell again what happened and why. Brother Glenn, verses 20 through 23 here in 2 Kings 17.
The Lord rejected all the seed of Israel and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of spoilers until he had cast them out of his sight. For he rent Israel from the house of David and then made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. And Jeroboam raised Israel from following the Lord and made them sin a great sin. For the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam which he did. They departed not from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said, by all his servants, the prophets. So was Israel carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day.
So there's the fulfillment of that prophecy in 1 Kings 14 by Ahijah. And the reason he gives to what happened to the nation of Israel, how does that compare to the words that Ahijah spoke to Jeroboam's wife there in 1 Kings 14 with what God was going to do to the nation and why? It's identical. Because Jeroboam, again, he points out how Jeroboam started it, but what does he say about the children of Israel? Jeroboam did make them sin a great sin. He says, for the children of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They departed not from them. So were they innocent? They weren't. Obviously, Jeroboam wasn't, and he suffered his consequences. But the people, for all those years, they all were guilty. Every one of them who followed those sins was guilty, and they bore their consequences from it. And it, just as Ahijah said would happen, it happened exactly that way. Great lesson from that, and it, however long it is, and God, how long did he put up with them? I mean, he put up with this for 200 years. By our standards, that's a long, long time. But still, God showed great long suffering to them over that time. But he pronounced what was going to happen, and he it happened. So eventually was their time of reckoning, but we can see the reasons why, because they did what was evil in God's sight. So after all that, then what ends up happening to that child when Jeroboam's wife leaves? Well, it tells us what the prophet said is exactly what happened. When she came to Tirzah, back in 1 Kings 14, 17, when she got to the threshold of the door, the child died. And then they buried him. All Israel mourned for him, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Ahijah. Then he says the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he warred, how he reigned, that are written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. He reigned for 22 years, and then he slept with his fathers. Nadab, his son, reigned in his stead. That's going to be a very brief reign, as we will, Lord willing, be reading about in the next chapter, in chapter 15. But before he goes into that, we have not been looking any at this man, Rehoboam, who became king, of course, at the same time that Jeroboam did, because that's when the split occurred. So everything has been about, that we've read about, he's been telling us about Jeroboam. And so we haven't seen really anything in 2 Chronicles other than the description of the division of the kingdom and those circumstances that we already read about. But 2 Chronicles concentrates on the kings of Judah. 1 Kings and 2 Kings primarily on the kings of the north, the kings of Israel. Well, he's going to mention Rehoboam now. The rest, the remainder of 1 Kings 14 is going to be about Rehoboam and what happened under him. So that's verses 21 through 31. But we also now are going to be looking at the parallel material that's going to occur in the book of 2 Chronicles. And so 2 Chronicles chapter 11 is going to tell us about Rehoboam's reign and on into chapter 12 there. So we'll have two chapters. So we're going to have a lot more to look at in 2 Chronicles than what we've been reading in than what we read about in 1 Kings. So, Lord willing, next Lord's Day, we want to finish up looking at what is there in 1 Kings chapter 14 about Rehoboam. But we're going to have more details to look at concerning Rehoboam in 2 Chronicles chapters 11 and 12. Now, there's a little more to the story from what we've been looking at here. We've read about Jeroboam and his sins and how the nation followed them and what happened to Jeroboam and what happened to his family and what ultimately happened to his kingdom, to the nation, that those 10 tribes in Israel for following those sins. was there not a Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego in any of those tribes through all those years? Did, especially at the start, was there not any righteous ones and all that that said, no, we're not going to follow, this is wrong? Were there any righteous ones in any of those tribes? I mean, obviously the majority of them weren't doing right. They had already exhibited that under when Solomon turned to his idols. They readily went that way. Were there any righteous anywhere in the northern kingdom? There were. And we're going to read about them, Lord willing. You can read about it right now. But anyway, in 1 Kings, it tells us about it in 2 Chronicles chapter 11, that there were righteous ones. In 2 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 13, he says, and the priests and the Levites that were in all Israel resorted to him out of all their coasts. So Jeroboam is making priests of the lowest of the people that were not sons of Aaron. So if you were a legitimate priest of the Lord in those places, what do you do? I mean, you can't. Can you take part in the things that Jeroboam's got? What he's starting? No. So what did the true priests, the righteous ones, do? They leave. They went to Judah. So is it just were there any good priests in Israel and all those tribes? Yes. They had the choice to either follow the evil or leave. What did they do? They left. They did what was the only right thing they could do under those circumstances. Then in verse 16 of 2 Chronicles 11, it says, and after them, out of all the tribes of Israel, such as set their hearts to seek the Lord God of Israel, came to Jerusalem to sacrifice to the Lord God of their fathers. So they strengthened the kingdom of Judah and made Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, strong 3 years. For 3 years they walked in the way of David and Solomon. But there were righteous Israelites from the other tribes there. So there were righteous priests and righteous Levites. And there were righteous people in all those tribes. They were the minority, but what did they do? They got out. That was their only choice. Either do the evil and be punished for it, or leave. Well, they went to the only place you could go. The only place where you could keep the commandments of God and not be forbidden or punished for doing so. They left and they joined themselves to Rehoboam and the kingdom of Judah, which gave strength to that kingdom. Here you have more righteous people becoming subjects of Rehoboam. So there were those that understood that point, that lesson, and didn't follow the multitude to do evil. They did have the fear of the Lord. They would not follow the sinner who enticed them. And they did what was right. Sadly, they were a minority, but they still followed the Lord. Well, we'll see more about that, Lord willing, next Lord's Day, and we'll close at this time. Let's see, Brother Aaron, would you lead us in prayer?